From Michigan Radio, this is a State of Opportunity special report, Better Together, How School Diversity Makes a Difference. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, our long history of segregation.
We decided as a country that we would segregate our neighborhoods and that we would maintain them through all kinds of discriminatory policies.
And making classrooms more diverse.
Really learning how to understand the values of other cultures, the values of other people groups at a young age is foundational and formational.
You know, I want my kids to see that there are people who understand them, who care to understand them, who don't want to just, you know, put them in a box.
It's 2017 now. Our nation's divided. I wonder if more people would have been and are exposed to different people if our compassion, our empathy as a nation could be in a different place.
But first, the news. Welcome to this State of Opportunity special report, Better Together, How School Diversity Makes a Difference. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just look at the racial census report of school districts in Michigan. The numbers from the State Department of Education prove districts in Michigan are largely segregated. This hour, we'll look at schools, teachers, and parents working to create, maintain, or even boost diversity in the classroom. Before we dive in, think back to your high school days. Just how diverse was your school?
I grew up in Saginaw, went to Saginaw Douglas MacArthur High School, which is no longer there. It was nicknamed White Haven because it was all white.
I went to high school in India, so they were all Indians. Back home, there's no way I could have had a Mexican teacher, an African classmate, and I think it's a unique experience that I absolutely love.
My high school was in a suburb of Detroit, so I was in the Metro Detroit area. It probably had about 90 to 95% white students, so it was not diverse at all.
My high school was a pretty typical high school. A lot of cliques. You know, you had the jocks, the intellects, the stoners, the smokers. But other than that, pretty normal, pretty diverse. One of the most diverse communities probably in the state of Michigan at the time.
Now more than ever, many feel we need to seek out and embrace the values of other cultures, other groups. First, though, let's look at the origins. How did we get to this point where schools in our state are so segregated? Here to help with that question is Joyce Baugh. She's a professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at Central Michigan University. And she's the author of the book, The Detroit School Busing Case, Milliken v. Bradley, and the Controversy Over Desegregation. Joyce, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Joyce, let's start right at kind of ground zero, if you will. What do you see as the main reasons for school segregation in Michigan?
Residential segregation.
Boy, you didn't take long answering that, did you?
No, I mean, it's where we live, because we have based our public school system on neighborhood schools for so long. Where we live determines where we go to school. Our state, like many other states, we have had very, very serious segregation and housing for many, many, many decades. And, you know, that segregation didn't happen by accident either. We can see it through restrictive covenants and redlining, steering and blockbusting, and where we placed public housing and highway development programs and urban renewal programs. And a whole range of things like that. And we can see that in the, you know, in the major metropolitan areas, Detroit, Grand Rapids, Lansing, Saginaw, all of those areas have been affected. You know, it's just that we decided as a country that we would segregate our neighborhoods and that we would maintain them through all kinds of discriminatory policies. You know, whether we're talking about federal and local governments or practices of realtors and banks. This is the system that we created. So that, you know, that's the primary driver, I would say, for school segregation all over the state.
So as this is going on, just becoming more and more baked into the system, we're seeing the economic decline in urban areas.
Exactly. So we go from there, we add in the economic decline. You were asking about Detroit earlier. You go from Detroit being a boom town in the early 1940s, right, through World War II, But then the city begins to suffer economic distress after that. And, you know, most people assume that the city's economic decline began after the racial uprisings in 1967. But that's not accurate. I mean, all of this decline begins shortly after World War II because manufacturing jobs declined tremendously. And then you have the problem of, or for some people it was a good thing, for others it was a problem, of automation, right? Once you begin to use all of the machines to replace workers, you have economic decline. And so you get then the flight of working class and middle class whites who can go to the suburbs using those FHA and VA loans, right, in the 1950s, and you dramatically reduce the tax revenue that is available in the cities for city services, including public education.
And then in 1974 comes this very important decision of Milliken v. Bradley, and that basically set us on this course, didn't it? It sealed the fate of urban schools in Michigan.
Right. Yes, it did.
Tell us about that case.
So Milliken v. Bradley was a case that challenged school segregation in the Detroit public schools. Eventually, a federal judge ordered a desegregation remedy that would involve the city schools in Detroit along with schools in 53 closely drawn suburbs in the Detroit metropolitan area. The case ended up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court rejected that remedy. The Supreme Court said that the illegal segregation existed only in the city of Detroit, that the suburban schools could not be part of the remedy. But the problem was that even though the suburban schools had not created specific policies to segregate their schools, they didn't have to because of housing segregation. There were no black students. There were very few, if any, black students to attend their schools.
And so what do you think solutions to school segregation could be? I mean, what's working well in other parts of the country?
Well, you know, we've really got this problem of continuing segregation and resegregation in other parts of the country as well. But what seemed to be really effective for many communities, particularly in the South, is that those school districts and those desegregation plans where you had the schools were set up on a countywide basis so that you had different communities in the same school district. For example, the Charlotte Mecklenburg County schools, they were organized on a countywide basis so that when the desegregation plan was put in place, you had students not only in the schools in the city of Charlotte, but at the county schools in Mecklenburg around there. So you could have then that urban-suburban connection.
What about at the state level? What could solutions look like at the state level?
I think the state could begin to figure out, we could think about ways to reorganize the way we've drawn our school districts and try to come up with plans that can pull together, you know, areas that are connected to each other. And the other thing, one of the programs that's been advocated by Gary Orfeel, who's been one of the main experts in school desegregation for a number of years, you know, he talks about creating more magnet schools, particularly in areas that have been gentrified. But that way you can pull in people from urban and rural and suburban areas and get those kids learning together. So, I just think that we have to figure out some way to respond to the original Milliken case by rearranging how our districts and how we think about drawing those school districts and doing it in a collaborative way.
Because we've seen the gerrymandering for school attendance lines, and those are keeping racial divisions baked in, aren't they?
Right, exactly. And if we can, have public policies that do the gerrymandering in negative ways, I don't see why we can't figure out some way to pull groups of people together to redraw those lines, to do gerrymandering in a more positive way.
Joyce, if we talk about school segregation in Michigan and don't see changes and don't see things evolve, as you say, you talked about positive gerrymandering, why not? What do you see for our future? What's the takeaway here?
I just think that we are going to continue to have a very segregated state. We're going to have segregated communities. We're going to have schools that continue to underperform because they're not funded well. And, you know, one of the things people have asked me, Cynthia, is I don't think that school desegregation, if we had had cross-district busing or cross-district desegregation, I don't know that that would have made a difference. The way I look at it is, I just don't believe that the Detroit public schools would have been allowed to deteriorate the way they did if white parents in suburban schools had been forced to send their children to those same schools. I think that you would have had them pushing for more adequate funding, and perhaps you would have had the state legislatures or the state legislature in Michigan, and I'm saying this sort of broadly, but the state legislature would have been willing, I think, to provide more equitable funding, more resources to all of the schools so that all of the children could be educated well. And I just think our future, I mean, if we're talking about young people as being our future, if we don't educate them, you know, well, I mean, I think that we are not doing our state a service.
Joyce Baugh, professor in the Department of Political Science and Public Administration at Central Michigan University. She's the author of The Detroit School Busing Case, Milliken v. Bradley, and the Controversy Over Desegregation. Thank you so much, Joyce, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for your interest in this important topic.
One teacher from West Michigan, one teacher from Dearborn, bringing their students together to learn lessons to last a lifetime.
Different cultures don't mean bad, and different cultures should be embraced.
You know, stories have the power to humanize, and when we have the chance to tell our stories to one another as individuals face to face, it's probably the most powerful thing in the world.
This is Better Together, a State of Opportunity special report from Michigan Radio. Welcome back to our State of Opportunity special report from Michigan Radio. Better Together. I'm Cynthia Canty. Education in America remains deeply segregated. At the same time, there are more students of color than ever before. In 2014, for the first time in America, minority students made up over 50% of public school enrollment. One district that has seen those shifting demographics firsthand is Plymouth Canton Community Schools. The district has been intentional about creating an environment where students and families from all backgrounds feel welcome. State of Opportunity producer April Van Buren has this story on how students are playing a role in that effort.
It's 3:00 on a Thursday afternoon, and this auditorium filled with dozens of teenagers is a little chaotic. They're here for a dress rehearsal of the school's annual Celebration of Diversity show.
Okay, guys, listen. I'm going to call out your number. Just raise your hand, okay?
A group of students practices their Bhangra steps while the Polynesian dancers pull grass skirts on over their jeans. The show's lineup is a reflection of the diverse backgrounds of the students here. Over the past 20 years, Plymouth Canton has gone from an almost all-white district to one where around 30% of the students are minorities. There are now more than 60 world languages spoken in the hallways. Rather than see this as a challenge, the district saw it as an opportunity. They started investing heavily in professional development to train their teachers in something called culturally proficient instruction. That means things like making sure the library has books with diverse characters, and that teachers incorporate the history and culture of their students into lesson plans. It also means empowering students to have their own conversations about race and culture and diversity. One place you can hear those conversations is at Borderless Club.
Using your privilege to take action.
Right? I mean, don't those advantages...
Over lunch, a group of around a dozen high school students talk about everything from white privilege to Asian stereotypes to their weekend plans. The mission of this group is to try and break down some of the barriers that exist between students at the district's three high schools. Maya Phelan is one of the club's founding members. She tells me just because the students at Plymouth Canton are diverse doesn't mean the schools are really all that integrated.
I think it goes back to the idea of having the clay in your hand and not being able to mold it. You have all these different people to learn from, and just having them there without discussing your differences with them is not going to benefit you.
If you really want students from different backgrounds to understand each other, Maya says, you have to be willing to roll up your sleeves and do some work. That means having tough discussions about the ways race and culture shape life in America.
I think, if anything, to bridge the gap between people, they have to start out doing just what we did, which is just sitting down and talking about it.
Right now, the club is planning a series of social justice activism workshops. They want to take what they've learned in Borderless Club and share it with the other student groups. Khadija Mohammed is another Borderless Club member. She says this kind of activism is a really important tool for social change. But she tells me personal interactions, those one-to-one conversations, can be just as powerful. Khadija's family immigrated to Minnesota from Sudan. They moved to Michigan when Khadija was in seventh grade. During her first year here, she was the only girl at her school who wore the hijab. One day, her gym teacher came up to her and asked her to take it off. It was getting in the way of her running, he said.
And I was like, listen, like, this is my religion. This is part of my religion. This is not just a cloth on my head. It is much deeper than that. I can't just take it off or put it on.
It was an awkward conversation, and one that left Khadija feeling hurt and angry. The next quarter, she had swim class. For modesty's sake, Khadija would sit out the hour on a bench beside the pool. And then something surprising happened. That same teacher started sitting next to her and asking her all kinds of questions about her Muslim faith.
And one day I walked into class, and I would never remember this, and he was like, if you can change your religion, would you change it so that you can allow it to allow you to swim in that swimming pool? And I was just like, no, not really. I really think my religion is beautiful the way it is, and I like it, so I'm not going to change it. And he looked at me, and he smiled, and he was like, good job. You know, it was just beautiful to see that now he was understanding where I'm coming from.
There's no easy fix for segregation in America's schools, but maybe there are some lessons to be learned from students like Maya and Khadija. As the country's schools continue to change, it isn't enough to just look diverse. We need to really listen to each other and to be willing to have uncomfortable conversations. If we do, the diversity in schools could teach students how to bridge divides outside their classroom walls, too. For State of Opportunity, I'm April Van Buren.
As neighborhoods and thus schools become more segregated, there are teachers who've decided to confront that head on, and they're not waiting for a grand solution from our elected leaders to appear. They know it's easy to get along with people who look like you, think like you, but they want to prepare their students for a world that is increasingly diverse. Lauren Robinson is a teacher at Hamilton High School. It's a rural school near Holland. Zainab Shami teaches at Fordson High School in Dearborn. The two work together to plan a field trip that's happening tomorrow. Lauren is bringing her students to Dearborn. They'll visit the Arab American National Museum and then head to Fordson and sit down and talk with Zainab's students. Zainab Shami is here with us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And from West Michigan via Skype, it's a pleasure to welcome Lauren Robinson. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. Thank you, Cindy.
Tell us a little, Lauren, about Hamilton High School and the community, particularly through the lens of diversity.
Sure. It's a school of about 800 students. Beautiful school, beautiful classrooms, everything, wonderful teachers and students. But as far as diversity goes, it's pretty homogenous, very white in general. And we don't get a ton of exposure to different ethnicities and cultures. So it has a rich culture of its own, but certainly not as diverse as where I grew up. So,
and you grew up in Dearborn.
I did, yes.
As did Zainab. And Zainab, you're actually teaching at the school you went to school at.
I did. Fordson's my alma mater.
Tell us about Fordson again through that diversity lens.
So Fordson is a school of about 2,700 students. About 50% of them are classified as English learners. It's a school that's almost 80% free reduced lunch, so we're a Title I school. Very large, probably 95% plus Arab American population, but within the Arab American population, there's diversity, you know, people from different countries. We also have a growing African American and Latino American community at Fordson, too. It is also a beautiful school. It was the first million-dollar high school in America. Henry Ford built it. So, yeah, I can't wait for Lauren's students to come and be wowed.
Well, I know, Lauren, you wrote to tell us that this new class you're teaching called Culture in America is kind of what led to this. What is the goal of that class, Culture in America?
Yeah, so the goal of it, I think, really is just increase empathy amongst our students and just help them to understand that different cultures don't mean bad and different cultures should be embraced. And in our country, we have so much exposure and so many amazing people and thoughts and ideas, and they aren't all like our own. And that really is a great thing to be celebrated. So I think that's the whole idea of it. This is the first trimester of it, and it's a one trimester class, but I'm teaching it again next try as well. And I've been really impressed with where the students are at and how they're thinking at this point and how excited they are about experiencing different culture. And it's been really cool.
And so your day that you're going to have for them tomorrow, you're leaving really early tomorrow morning, I understand.
We are. For me, it's not that early, but for the students, they can't even believe it. We're leaving around 6:45, and we won't get home till around 6 as well. So it'll be a long day for them.
And I can guarantee you it'll be very quiet on that bus because they'll all be sleeping as you
oh,
head
yeah,
to Dearborn. But the stop at the Arab American Museum is important, isn't it?
It is, definitely. I really want them to have the facts, and I want them to have the figures, and I want them to know, you know, who it is that they're learning about. And then going to Fordson and actually meeting people that might somewhat resemble, you know, what they learned about at the museum, I think that's so important.
And Zainab, what have you got planned for Lauren's students and your class when they come together?
You know, we have an icebreaker planned. We just have an hour to work with our kids because she's coming at the end of our school day. You know, we have an icebreaker planned, and then we are going to facilitate dialogue. So we have a panel discussion, and then we want the kids to sit in small groups because teenagers generally have a lot to talk about. They usually end up talking about what they have in common rather than the differences they have. I mean, we've facilitated dialogues like this before at Fordson.
What kind of questions do you want to use as prompts?
So I'm wondering what questions Lauren's students have. The take-home, the takeaway from all of this is that every human is an individual. And you know, stories have the power to humanize. And when we have the chance to tell our stories to one another as individuals face to face, it's probably the most powerful thing in the world. So what I want my kids to take home, as well as Lauren's kids, is that everybody's different. You know, white people are not a monolith. Arabs are not a monolith. We all have more in common as human beings than we have differences.
Lauren, when I say the phrase cultural empathy, what does that mean to you?
I think what it means is that you can, in some way, shape, or form, put yourself in someone else's shoes and know that not everybody has had the experience that my students have had, and that because of where they grew up or how they grew up or something of that nature, they might not have had the privileges that some of my students have had. And I think trying to get them to think outside of, you know, like I said earlier, different cultures are bad. Trying to get them to think outside of that and know why they're thinking outside of that, that I think is what it means to me. It means feeling versus just facts and figures.
And Zainab, it's different than sympathy, isn't it?
Absolutely.
How?
So I teach a social justice class, and one of the first things we learn is sympathy versus empathy. So sympathy is this well-meaning, almost pity, whereas empathy is experiencing the human emotions that other people are experiencing and feeling with them, feeling alongside them, seeing them as equals. And, you know, when people are sympathetic with one another, they're not seeing one another as equals. And that's the issue.
Now, I understand both of you have kind of confronted this really in your own way, cultural empathy or lack of it. Lauren, what surprised you as you planned this field trip to Fordson as far as reaction of some parents?
Well, and it hasn't been a lot, but I did have some students that said, you know, my parents are really uneasy about this, or my parents don't want me to do this, or just going to Dearborn, I think, is scary to some people. And I understand it if there is some sort of lack of exposure and they don't know about Dearborn and such, that can be a little scary. But it was just weird. It was just interesting for me coming from Dearborn as my hometown to hear someone say, you know, my parents don't want me to be there. I don't know. It was just a very interesting thought that I had never thought of.
I'm just curious, were you able to at all ask the parents why, or was that one of those maybe battles best left unfought?
I think at this point it might be a battle best left unfought right now. I'm hoping that if this catches on and this idea kind of comes to fruition, I think that maybe the culture will start to change a little bit, and a little bit more accepting will be kind of the norm. It's all been pretty new and fresh, and I don't want to make too many waves at this point.
No, we learn to pick our battles.
Right.
That's right.
And Zainab Shami, you're a Muslim woman. You wear a headscarf, which is a very important expression of your faith. What has that presented for you in, for example, traveling around Michigan?
I'm pretty insulated in Dearborn, and I feel, you know, very comfortable in Dearborn. But there are certain parts of the state. I mean, and this is personal. It's mm-hmm. not everyone feels the same, right? But there are certain parts of the state where I kind of fear to go to. I probably wouldn't go to alone. And I mean, it is the nature of things. I think I commend people like Lauren who are trying to change things within their spheres of influence. That's the most important thing we can do. But unfortunately, we don't have enough Laurens in the world.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you think of the kind of environment that our country is going through right now, where social media lets everyone stay in their own silos, that echo chamber, and you realize that both of your schools are pretty homogenous. And so right. You want to bring them. How important is it to bring these two sets of kids together in a day of diversity?
It is so important to me. You know, my students, just knowing that they're going to be in Dearborn, I am telling you right now, every single day for the past week or so, they've been asking more questions and they've been more excited. And today we were talking about it and some of the kids said, well, okay, can we ask the question, you know, why do females wear hijab? Or can we ask this question or this question?
And I hope they do ask that.
It's been so awesome. It's been so awesome.
Yeah. And how have the kids been from your end?
So we only have a handful of kids mm-hmm. coming because of the timing. But, I mean, they're always excited to talk about their own experiences. You know, teenagers' favorite topic of conversation is themselves.
It's true.
So they're excited. And I love it because kids this age are coming purely, it's an experiential thing. Like they're not going to come with politically correct lines. They're just going to be talking about their experiences as human beings. Again, that's the most powerful thing. That's how you humanize the other with a capital O, right? And I want to share this quote from the Nigerian author Chimamanda Adichie, who said, stereotypes are dangerous not because they're untrue, but because they're incomplete. I mean, I think this is where coming together becomes very important. Again, you can't overstate how important it is for people to be able to share their stories and humanize themselves.
You're planting a seed, both of you, as teachers. How do you want to help that seed grow, to have your students, have these kids grow into people who do have cultural empathy?
I really hope that even in smaller conversations within the school, students will start to maybe care more about the other side, whatever that conversation is, and maybe go out on their own at some point and try to engage in some sort of other cultural activity or something, engage with people of other cultures, whereas maybe beforehand they would have been scared to or afraid to. because they had never done it before. And so I think for me, that's really where I want to see it grow. I'd love to see this class grow and the curriculum and the students, but I'd certainly like to see it grow outside of this place as well.
I mean, I want to see that for my students as well. Obviously, I teach at a homogenous school too, but I mean, I think with the recent election, I'm going to be honest, there was some fear in my classroom and around the school and around the community. I want my kids to see that there are people who understand them, who care to understand them, who don't want to just, you know, put them in a box and leave them behind. So it will be good for them to have this interaction, this positive interaction with a group of people, I think, whom they would assume had assumptions about them. So it's really breaking down layers of walls.
And you're going to prepare them for moving on, what they may encounter on a college campus.
Absolutely.
And in the workplace.
Absolutely.
Well, we wish you a lot of luck with tomorrow's field trip. Lauren Robinson teaches at Hamilton High School, a rural school near Holland, and she'll be bringing students to Fordson High School in Dearborn, where Zainab Shami teaches, and the kids are going to be meeting together, and we can't wait to hear how it all goes. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks, Cindy.
Still to come, tackling classroom segregation by creating Detroit's first intentionally diverse charter school.
Our mission wasn't ever to open a school that served all affluent white kids. That's never been what we wanted to do.
You're listening to Better Together, a State of Opportunity special report from Michigan Radio. Welcome back. You're listening to a State of Opportunity special report, Better Together, How School Diversity Makes a Difference. When we talk about segregated schools, we need to look no further than Detroit. Census figures from the State Department of Education tell us Detroit's a city where more than 82% of its students are African American, just 2% are white, and only 0.24% are multiracial. A new charter school on Detroit's east side in the Indian Village neighborhood is working hard to change that. Detroit Prep is a free public charter school authorized by Grand Valley State University. Right now, it's got kindergarten and first grade students. Its founders were determined that Detroit Prep would be the city's first intentionally diverse charter school. So they set out by casting a wide net in recruiting students and in offering strong academics. Our Lester Graham sat down with co-founder Kyle Smitley.
Charter schools are criticized for furthering racial segregation in Detroit and some of the surrounding suburbs. So when you opened Detroit Prep, you were well aware of that issue. How did you handle it?
Detroit Prep's our second school. So we have a first school that serves a predominantly student of color population. And so we knew what the landscape looked like. And we also knew that we were getting emails and phone calls from families who were mixed race, white, of a varying socioeconomic level of diversity. And we knew we were getting phone calls from them, from the other side of town. And they were saying essentially, like, I moved to Detroit. I don't want it to be a 5-year plan. I don't want to have to move to the suburbs. I live in Detroit because my student and I both value diversity culturally. I want them to go to a school that reflects that. Being the only white kid in a school isn't exactly what I'm looking for with that level of diversity, but if there was a really authentically, intentionally diverse school, that would be a great fit for me. So we basically responded to that.
Now, you can't just pick and choose who applies and goes to your school. You can't discriminate based on race. How do you make a diverse school then?
Right. We're a free public school. So anyone in the state of Michigan who wants a seat at our school gets it. And how we were able to accomplish our goal of creating an intentionally diverse school this time was making sure that our net for recruitment was as wide as possible. So making sure that we were able to actually and really intentionally reach all types of families. For example, if we just sent a bunch of newsletters out or if we just posted on Facebook, we would only capture the select group of parents that respond to those things. So on Facebook only, typically a super affluent, skewing white group of people respond. And we knew that we needed to just really differentiate our recruitment.
Detroit Prep is new, as we mentioned. How successful were you in getting a diverse classroom?
For our first school year, we were extremely successful. So 53% of our students are Black, 38% of our students are white, and 9% are mixed race. I think another really exciting thing is how diverse our school is socioeconomically. We have a 65% free lunch rate, and so it's a 35% paid rate. It was great. We couldn't have wished for anything better. And I think then seeing the impact it has on our students now puts even more fire in our belly to maintain that level of diversity.
How did you manage to follow the law but still manage this diverse classroom? Because there are those restrictions, as I mentioned earlier.
Yeah. So the bounds of the law say that an enrollment period has to be open for 2 weeks. It has to be advertised in two places. So that's sort of what the law says. And the law says whoever applies gets a seat. And we follow that law to the T, right? Absolutely, strictly follow that law. The way that we're able to bring a little bit of strategy into it is having an enrollment period that lets us say, like, okay, who's chomping at the bit waiting? Okay, great. So we have those people. Those people are captured in that two-week period. They're here. They've been waiting for us to open our enrollment period. They're here. What does that population look like? Is it white? Is it black? Is it rich? Is it poor? Okay, where are the deficiencies in order to create the diverse school and student body? And then how do we take that information and do a lot of strategic outreach based on that? So if it's skewing white, you know, how do we bring in an increasing population of students of color? If it's skewing poor, how do we meet more affluent families to bring that socioeconomic diversity into it?
You've been criticized because you're in a city that's right around 80% African American, but your classroom doesn't reflect that. So how do you justify not taking in more black kids?
It is what it is. We're a public school. We get who we get.
With strategy behind it.
With strategy behind it. But I think, like, if you were to ask us what our ideal split looked like, I'm not sure that it would look like a 50-50 exact split. I think it might be more reflective of the city and the background, or the background of most of our neighbors, rather. That's something we grapple with, right? Like, to what end? We want kids to be able to navigate lines of difference, but does that mean that our school has to reflect the exact demographics of Detroit? If so, why? I don't know. I don't think we have an answer to that. I don't think a lot of our families have an answer to that. I don't know if Detroit has an answer to that, right? Like, I don't know if Detroit would say, like, every school has to be reflective of the exact demographic breakdown of the, you know, 2010 census. Like, I'm not sure that that's where the value is. And so for us, basically, we say, okay, great. Who wants to be here? Based on that initial population, like, how can we bring more diversity into it? And I think, to what end? I don't know. But yeah, I guess that's the population we're trying to create.
As I mentioned at the top, we've seen further segregation because of charter schools, because of whom they are serving. I'm wondering, are the charter schools looking at your intentional diverse classroom and rethinking how they recruit students?
I wonder. I don't know. I hope. I think what we found is that with affluence comes the privilege, and it's a privilege, of choice. And of preparedness and of research and of connections with school founders and things like that. And if you are affluent enough to have that choice, you are not going to choose a low-performing school. In addition to high rate of segregation, Detroit also has an extremely high rate of terrible, terrible, terrible schools. And so they're not doing anything to attract any diversity by being so terrible. The one thing that we had going for us is that we were already a world-class school. So our first school was already an excellent, excellent school. And so we were able to say, hey, you have the privilege of choice. You have the privilege and the option to move to Grosse Pointe, to move to Birmingham. We're telling you not to. We're telling you that we will serve your kid. We will create this really rich and diverse environment for your student. So yeah, I don't know. I wonder if they're learning. I hope so. For Detroit to move forward, schools have to serve all kids and all kids that want to be here.
How are you recruiting for next year? Are you recruiting yet?
Yeah, so our enrollment period for next year already closed.
That's early.
Yeah, it's really early. And I think we're open to pushing it back a little later, for sure. I don't think that the earliness of it is what pushes our success one way or the other. I think we could have it in January or February. But to sort of push back a little bit, I think that part of our job is also to sort of raise the bar for all kids in Detroit. And I think that if we just sort of roll over and say, families here are just not savvy enough to start thinking about their kids' education until August or July, let's just keep the bar where it is. I don't think that we're serving families and kids that way either. In other cities, schools and enrollment periods open in November, December, January. It's not surprising. So I think for us to push families to say, no, if you want a great school, this is when you have to start thinking about it and providing them the support to do that. So, and we are doing that, right? Like, we're reaching out to Head Starts. We're saying, no, now is the time that you need to be thinking of where you're sending your kid to school.
The Head Starts are where you're recruiting some of the low-income black kids?
Typically.
You've been called sneaky because of your low-key application period and the early application period, the attempt to get this racially and economically diverse classroom. How do you feel about that?
I mean, I never like being called sneaky. But at the same time, I think that following publicly being called sneaky, we definitely had a little huddle with some of our families. And we said, like, you know, any reflections from the article, any pushback, what feedback do you guys have for us? And the general sentiment was just like, no, we appreciate the diversity and you're operating well within the bounds of the law. And if there was another legal lever that you could pull that wasn't so sneaky, you would be pulling that lever. You're advocating for that lever. We're right now internally working on a policy memo around diverse schools to see if maybe there can be some traction in actually pushing forward a law where there could be, in many other states, where there could be a lever to pull where a school would apply to have a diverse student body and things like that.
This article you're talking about, what is that the parents saw?
An article in The Atlantic and in Chalkbeat talking about our enrollment methods, but also, I think, really highlighting our diversity.
How would you change Michigan law in order to have more diverse classrooms?
Well, that's way above my pay grade. But I think in other states, I'm thinking of Texas and North Carolina, there is a sort of application-based system where you can apply to have a weighted lottery. So you can apply to say, you know what, we want to weight our lottery so that 80% of our seats go to low-income families and 20% go to high-income families. As far as I know, there aren't any states that allow a racial lottery. I think that you get into pretty tricky territory with something like that. But an income-based lottery, I think, would be really exciting, and I think it would be really great for all schools, not just in Detroit, right? I think it'd be great for every single school as we start to see, you know, a gap in the class system. I think it'd be great to make sure that kids are able to navigate lines of difference and all lines of difference.
An intentionally diverse school like Detroit Prep wouldn't succeed without supportive parents. Matt Schmidt recently came back to Southeast Michigan after some years in L.A. Home is now Detroit's East Side. His 7-year-old daughter, Charlotte, is a first grader at Detroit Prep. Sherelle Jones and her family moved to Detroit from Brooklyn, New York. Her daughter, Sage, is a kindergartner. I sat down with Sherelle and Matt in a classroom at Detroit Prep to talk about why the diversity at this school is exactly what they want for their children.
Now, I know you've both been in education. Sherelle, you're an early childhood arts educator. You've been in Teach for America, Matt. So what do you see Detroit Prep doing right in terms of building a diverse student body?
So what I see, I mean, I look at books in a classroom when I come in. I look at sort of like who are the characters, who are the heroes in these stories. There's diversity represented there. I look at how they take into account who the kids are. They have a very much of a, like an expectation of how kids are supposed to be in culture, in the culture of the school. But they definitely take into account who these kids are, where they're coming from. They go to lengths to try to make sure everyone can be part of everything, all the parents. I mean, we all have different work schedules. They have call-in things. I mean, they're still developing these tactics, but they have a real heart for making sure that everyone can feel part of this community and everyone can be involved across race, across socioeconomics. And I haven't seen such intentionality like that really ever before.
And what about the student body mix?
Yeah, also, I feel like they do a great job to integrate the kids with each other. My daughter is having some issues with some kids that want to play with her, and some, you know, they're going through that. And we've just been really impressed with how her teacher takes the time to step in and say, okay, you need to make this right with each other. You need to talk with each other. And they really do take those character things like integrity, responsibility, accountability, and all of those things together. It's a really impressive place.
Yeah, absolutely. I would just echo what you're saying. I feel that the exposure to other students have been huge for Sage. And just thinking if she was at a school where, you know, everybody looked like her and everybody, you know, had the same background as her, which is not my experience at all, but I feel like I wouldn't see the growth that she has shown this year just as a person and understanding that people are different, and but we're so very much the same at the same time, and being tolerant and being curious also. Like I was just telling Jen and Matt that Sage really wanted her hair in pigtails. Well, we have very, very curly hair. Like, her hair defies gravity. And so it's like, if you really want it in pigtails, like, you have to go through a lot. Like, I have to put a lot of heat in your hair, and we have to, it's going to be a really long process, but you know, her friend has pigtails, but her friend naturally has straight hair. So I think it was just a learn it. Like, that to me was a lesson for her also. Like, you know, you're different. And if you want to look the same as her, like, it takes, like, you have to go through these steps. And if she wanted her hair curly like yours, she would have to go through a huge process also. So
yeah, I was, my wife and I were reflecting on this This American Life piece that Nicole Hannah-Jones did a few years back. And it was all about the importance of integration, that a lot of people are afraid of integrated schools because they feel like there's going to be some sort of like diminishing of quality. But the studies show that integrated schools are actually really good for everyone, right? And so that's huge to us. I mean, I think a lot of times we hear that, you know, we think about integration in terms of how it helps lower income kids in city districts. But for us, it's really important that our daughters, who are both pink-skinned Anglo kids, have leaders of color, have friendships of color, with people of color. And the school right now is working on that, but because the leadership here is not as diverse as I would like to see it, but they are definitely working on that. But to have Charlotte come home and be drawing pictures of her friends and really carefully thinking about the shades of skin tone, right? And really not just this is brown, this is white, but she's really like mixing things to be like, this really looks like this friend and this really looks like that friend. It's pretty awesome to see.
So at a very, very tiny age, they are learning to negotiate lines of difference, mm-hmm. which is something that sometimes people go their whole lives without really absorbing. And what price do you think we pay as, you know, as a community, as a state, as a nation, living in those kinds of silos that you just described?
I think it's embarrassing that we are in this country, that we still live like that. I think that's one thing. I think we pay huge prices because I'm seeing men my age, white men my age, who are struggling right now to handle diversity in the workforce. But like they are really struggling their sense of self-worth. They don't understand. They feel like there's racism against them. All of these things, I think, could be mitigated at an earlier age if people learn how to appreciate difference. And I think a lot of times you need to have an appreciation of diversity, not just conformity, right? So like, what is real diversity? Diversity isn't, we have black students, but we make them straighten their hair. Like, we make them not, that's a choice they can have. But, like, there's those tales you hear of school districts are, like, sending kids home when their hair isn't done right. Like, that's not diversity, right? That's conformity. And so really learning how to understand the values of other cultures, the values of other people groups at a young age is foundational and formational. And I think if we don't, we all run the risk of just having animosity later, which we're absolutely seeing right now.
Yeah, I feel like I also work in the suburbs, along with working with kids in the city of Detroit who experience more diversity. And I feel like there's a depth of character that they exhibit and in their artistry also that you just don't see from kids that are in these bubbles. Mm-hmm. And I think that's been my experience of it as a teacher and educator. And that's the saddest part for me is that, you know, it's because I don't know what about it, what about being around people who are different than you that just creates more of a depth of character. I would love to see that's changed and we are more inclusive of a lot of different people and that's inserted into all early education.
Let me jump on that. When I was a Teach for America teacher, I was in New Orleans, right? And I was this, you know, Teach for America at that time, it still is like, you know, takes high-performing college seniors, right? Which also, if you do the full, like, spectrum, it's like they're perfectionists, they, like, are like, they're type A, right? Like, not all of us. But so, like, you take them into a situation, put them in a first-year teaching scenario, and they are going to start experiencing failure like they've never experienced before, right? And so here I was, you know, this white kid from the Detroit area and moved down to New Orleans, like culture shock on top of culture shock. I was teaching in a mostly African-American and Vietnamese school, and I was bitterly failing, right? So depth of character, right? Like, here's what I would say. That perfectionist in me who wanted to go down and save all these poor black kids, poor Vietnamese kids, that needed to die, right? And so I suffered with that, and I was struggling, and the parents in that community reached out and would invite me over for gumbo and say, like, Mr. Schmidt, we don't need you to be perfect. We just need you to teach our kids, right? There's different perspectives, right? There's a different sense of wisdom that a black grandma gives to you than your, you know, your white grandma who went through the Depression and had her own sense of wisdom that she gives. But there's a sense of humor I got in New Orleans that, like, it saved my life in a lot of ways. Like, I really had a lot more grace with myself. I had a lot more patience. And those kinds of things get developed when you have different cultural components coming to the table. I'm speaking in generalities, but I'm saying that for me, it was life-changing.
That was my conversation with Detroit Prep parents Sherelle Jones and Matt Schmidt. And that's our State of Opportunity special report, Better Together, How School Diversity Makes a Difference. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, April Van Buren, and Nick Wallace. A special thank you to Erin Einhorn at Chalkbeat Detroit. You can find her article on Detroit Prep at chalkbeat.org. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for spending this hour with us.